Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. So hello and welcome to the Washboard Resonators Presents. Today we're having a conversation with vintage jazz drummer, educator and radio presenter and festival organiser, Mr. John Petters. So I met John probably several years ago because when I was trying to get into some of this music, I was Googling some British guys that were playing in the style of Baby Dodds and Dudie Singleton and Gene Krupa and guys like this. And John came up as a big hit, and I still think he's one of the best Krupa style drummers in the UK, and he's kind of taken me under his wing a bit, and he's booked me on some of his festivals that he runs, which we'll get onto later. And I went down to his house about a 2.5 hour drive away. He basically gave me some great tips, and the most important thing was he gave me loads of music on a lot of these guys, not just drummers but just amazing jazz musicians of the era. And I still refer back to them whenever a name comes up. Like the other day, a new name came up, and it was on one of these CDs he gave me. So he's just an encyclopedic knowledge of trad jazz, basically. And he's played with all the big names of the, I think it was in the 80s when he was playing with them, but he's booked festivals. He was regular at the 100 Club. He's got a very cool drum kit, and he's just all things knowledgeable on the style of jazz. So looking forward to getting into conversation with him and his career and his life. So hi, John. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for doing this today.
Hello, both. And thank you for asking me.
Okay, so we're going to just do a kind of general conversation about your career and things you've got up to. So we'll start off. So where are you from originally?
I was born in Stratford in East London.
But you don't live there now, I don't think?
No, I now live in the Lincolnshire Fens in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, lovely, lovely. What a dream. And so what I'm always interested in when we're interviewing people is, so what first got you interested in music? Did you start off on drums?
Well, I started long before I was ever playing, because from a very young age, I used to watch my granddad's radiogram. It was what they called an auto changer in those days, playing 78 RPM records. And I was fascinated with that. I used to be more interested in the labels on the records than what was actually on the records music-wise. And I would guess that this probably started when I was about 2 years old.
Wow.
So we're looking at from, let's say, because I was born in 53, so we're into the era of the traditional jazz revival in this country, and also skiffle days and rock and roll, of course. So I heard a lot of different types of music that my uncles had. They had quite a few rock and roll records. So I heard people like Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley and that sort of thing. My granddad had quite a wide variety of different things. And I can remember hearing that my first jazz record that I heard was Louis Armstrong's Basin Street Blues.
Great.
The commercial 10-inch Brunswick single that had a wonderful drum solo in it. And I later got very confused because I later saw the movie The Glenn Miller Story and assumed that the drummer on the recording on the 78 was Gene Krupa. It wasn't, of course. It was Kenny Johns. Gene was in the film version. So that was the first jazz that I consciously was aware of. And I'm also remembering that he had another 78 called There'll Be No New Tunes on This Old Piano by a piano player called Bill Krenz, who I later discovered is a ragtime piano player, American ragtime piano player. And I recently managed to get hold of a single copy of that. And I recall now that was a very early bit of jazz experience that I heard way, way back.
So do you think you were kind of drawn to the jazz compared to the rock and roll? And you also said the labels drew you. Was that just because the age you were now, or do you think there's something interesting about the labels themselves?
No, I mean, it's the age that I was. You know, I like particular patterns on labels, and I used to like watching the records drop down and the pickup arm playing them and all of that sort of thing. So subsequently, whenever I had birthdays or Christmas presents, people always bought me 78 records or wind-up gramophones, and I would always overwind them and bust the springs and that sort of thing. So, of course, I heard a wide variety of different music. So I was hearing, let's say, for example, Bing Crosby. My dad was a fan of Bing Crosby. I was hearing Mario Lanza, so I got to hear some operatic tenors. I got very early on recordings of Gilbert and Sullivan, The Yeoman of the Guard, and that sort of thing. I was hearing Dvorak, Smetana, other classical pieces that I got on these 78 discs. Also, of course, a lot of the dance bands, people like Roy Fox and Ambrose, Ray Starita, and all of the British dance bands and so on. I was also very aware of Lonnie Donegan, of course, which was another important figure in my early days, because my uncles had the Lonnie Donegan 78s that were, of course, in the top 20 and that sort of thing in those days. So all of this was being mixed up, and by the time I got into my teens, I got really heavily into rock and roll.
Oh, cool.
In particular Buddy Holly and that sort of stuff. So when my friends were collecting records by the Beatles, I was going up and making special orders for old 1950s rock and roll recordings, and that sort of, I was also listening to a degree to the pirate radio stations that were around at that time. And I started to lose interest in pop music by about 1967. And then the BBC ran a series of Bing Crosby movies on BBC Two. And of course, I had recollections of that from having umpteen dozen Brunswick 78s of Bing. And I started watching these, and I thought, well, you know, there's some real depth in this music. And then they played Rhythm on the River, and that featured Wingy Minone's New Orleans band. And they were talking about New Orleans music, Dixieland music, and jazz. So, of course, I had a real resonance for all the stuff that I'd been hearing. And during the course of collecting these 78s, I heard Johnson's band with Baby Dodds and George Lewis and people like that on a His Master's Voice 78 of When the Saints and Darktown Strutters Ball. I had a Kid Ory 78 on Good Time Jazz. I'd heard a few of the British trad things, as I was aware of Humphrey Littleton and people like that. So, you know, it sort of had resonance. After seeing the Crosby movie of Rhythm on the River, I decided that I would go to the local shop and see what I could get in the way of New Orleans jazz records. And I found an album called New Orleans Jazz Men in the 12 and 6 rack, the cheap rack. And that had Kid Ory's band, and that was the only name that I knew. George Lewis's band, who I didn't know because I wasn't aware he was on the Bunk Johnson 78. And Papa Celestin's band, which had a wonderful drummer called Black Happy Goldston on it. And that was what really started. So I would start going into the record shops and buying anything in the jazz rack and listening to it. So I got records by Pee Wee Hunt, you know, the 12th Street Rag, and that's the thing which I'd also had on a 78. I think an early record I bought was Harry Roy's Orchestra from the 1930s. British dance band, but very jazzy, with Joe Daniels on drums, I discovered. And that's the thing. It went from there, really. Oh, what I have left out is that my uncle Mick was a drummer. He never played any gigs, but he had a drum kit set up in migrants' house where he lived. And he had a vast collection of jazz records and rock and roll records. And that is where I first heard the name Gene Krupa, because he had quite a few Krupa records, including the single that Gene did with Buddy Rich of Perdido and Night Train. So I heard that earlier on. He had the album of Drumming Man, the Columbia recordings from the 40s. movies and that sort of thing. I heard Sandy Nelson, the rock and roll drummer, so yeah, that was part of the mix. He had tons of percussion with... sorry, Jack?
I say he's a very similar... I think he models himself on Gene Krupa quite a lot, yeah, doesn't he? The style of it, it's... Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, all of that was going on in that period.
So it was your uncle that started you on drums, really. Did you ever look at any other instruments? Or were you particularly drawn to it? Or is it just that was the instrument that you were around, really?
Well, I didn't start playing until I was about 18 or 19. And the reason for that is that when I was at just around the time when I was getting involved in listening to jazz, so I'd have been 15, 16, that sort of age. I had a school friend of mine, a chap named Dave Bondi, who was a clarinet player and drummer. Dave also knew a lot more about music than I did. I have to say that I got ungraded CSE music at school, which is the worst of the worst. Dave and I started listening to records. He used to skive off school, and I think at the time I was unemployed. So we would just start listening and messing around and playing. And my Uncle Mick had given my brother Stephen his old drum kit, and that was in one of the rooms in our house.
What kit was it?
Oh, it was just a put together bit. I don't even remember what the make was, and I certainly have got now, but it was just a thrown together thing. So I got those out, but before I did that, I wanted to play soprano sax, because I heard a recording of Bechet on Hump's Best of Jazz program, and I went off looking for Bechet records, and the woman in the record shop said Sydney who. Looked it up, and there was the album on Blue Note, Jazz Classics, which I ordered, and it came, and I was bowled over by that. That's where I first heard Art Hodes, because he's on some of the tracks on there. So I wanted to play soprano sax. We got hold of a soprano sax, couldn't get on with it. I didn't have a very good melodic aptitude. I seemed to be more... sort of leaning towards the rhythmic than the melodic.
So you think, I decided... You sing well, though, John. I've heard you sing. Are you doing the spiritual stuff?
Well, years later, I decided that I was going to get some voice training. And I'll come to that a bit later in the story if you want to go down that route. Sure. So at the beginning, it was drumming. And I had... This is around the time that Louis Armstrong died, so around 1971, and I heard the Hot Fives. The first Hot Five that I heard was Gut Bucket Blues.
Cool.
And I was knocked out by this. And the great thing about the Hot Fives is that there are no drums on them, so I could accompany the Hot Fives myself. And the similar thing occurred with the Quintet at the Hot Club of France, the Django, Stefan Grappelli things.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would try and teach myself purely by ear. And I've been reading jazz books at this time. And there was this great romantic notion that jazz musicians couldn't read music, weren't interested in reading music, and taught themselves. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted that romantic notion of a self-made jazz as musician. It was a bad mistake, because years later I had to go back and learn the rudiments, and I had correct tuition. Yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to say, it's fascinating to hear that. So when you started doing it that way, did it come quickly, or was it a very long process playing those records?
Yes, it was a very long process.
That's what I imagine. But I also imagine there's probably no better grounding just for feel and jazz feel than those two bands. They're both astonishingly tight, swinging, amazing bands as well. So that's a good grounding in one way, probably terrible in others. So you had to learn to read, did you say?
Well, I also learned where the breaks came.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was quite useful. I'd heard the original Dixieland Jazz Band records around that time as well, and read the book by H.O. Brunn that was quite interesting. And I'd read, I think, probably Marshall Stern's The Story of Jazz and various other books. I was getting interested in the history side of it as well. Dave and I had started going to the local jazz club. And one of the first bands that I saw there was Johnny Bastable's Chosen Six, which was the remnants of the Ken Collier band. And we saw a drummer there called Malt Murphy, who's still active on the scene today. And Malt played a very primitive style of drum kit, you know, real heads and that sort of thing. And he was playing lots and lots of press rolls and blocks and so on. A little later, I saw the Collier band itself with Colin Bowden.
Cool.
Who was doing precisely that. And we started, but by that time, Keith Donald, my bass playing friend, he'd taken up bass guitar around the same time that I started playing drums. And we started going to see Max Colley's Rhythm Aces, who were very big in London at that time. And Ron McKay was on drums with Max, who is the other, you know, sort of main British drummer that I spent a lot of time listening to. And Ron, again, is press roll bust and all of the early sort of New Orleans drumming styles and that sort of thing. So I was able to see visually what I needed to do on the kit. And again, by listening to records, very difficult listening to old records from the 20s and even into the 30s, really, because the drums are way, way down in the mix, if they're there at all.
Yeah.
And I got hold of fairly early on a sampler on RCA Black and White, which contained one of the Jelly Roll Morton tracks, The Chant. It had I Hope Gabriel Likes My Music by Gene Krupa's Swing Band, and you could really hear the drums on there. Brilliant. And
really fast, know, that as well, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that name had resonances for me. Dave and I went to see Benny Goodman in 1971 at the Albert Hall, and then again in 72.
Cool.
In fact, we saw him three times, once with a British big band and twice with a sextet.
Do you remember? Do you remember like any? Sorry, as I say, do you remember any? No, like, how did that make you feel? Like seeing the first time, was he one of your big heroes by now?
Not exactly. I first bought the Benny Goodman Story LPs around about this time.
When is this time, please?
Well, about 1971, 72, about the time I'm beginning to start. Sure. Playing. So I'd heard the Benny Goodman Story records. We bought the albums that came out with the live bands that we saw of Benny at the Albert Hall. And I said to Dave at the time that I you know, really knocked out. Bobby Orr was the drummer on the big band things, and you know, Sing Sing Sing, of course, was the feature, but he played nothing like Gene. You know, it was no tom toms or anything like that.
Oh wow, that's bold these days. Sing 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 always has tom toms,
snare drum and that's the stuff he was using. Lots of ride cymbal, and I don't mean press rolls, you know, he brought the intro in on the snare drum without any tom toms, as I recall. I've still got the records. And Dave said, well, if you think that's good, listen to this. And he got hold of the Carnegie Hall 1938 recording.
Yeah.
And that blew me away, as you know, you might well imagine. So I got on to the Krupa trail by then. So I started buying Krupa records and listening and studying. I also went back to Baby Dodds because I started to hear the Bill Russell American Music records. I got the King Oliver records. I was listening to Bix, Jelly Roll Morton, and the early classic jazz and revivalist New Orleans jazz. Bechet, lots of Bechet, Wild Bill and Bechet and that sort of stuff.
Did you have kind of guidance on this? Were people telling you, oh, you need to hear this record and find this, or were you kind of finding it yourself? Or because this wasn't current music still now, but it was about.
Well, my record buying trips were up to the local record shop every week, and I would buy anything in the rack that was under the jazz rack. So I was buying all sorts of modern stuff as well. Mm. You know, things like Stan Kenton and Parker and Gillespie and all of that sort of stuff. Dave was buying Miles Davis. This was at the time that Miles Davis was doing his Live Evil stuff and Bitches Brew. And all that sort of jazz rock stuff, which I never got into at all. So, you know, we were listening to jazz of quite a wide variety. And the more I got listening to it, the more I decided that I wasn't interested really in anything post the swing era. So I wanted to go back, you know. Bebop really didn't do an awful lot for me. I could recognize that it was very, very clever stuff. But it didn't have that sort of emotional feel that early styles of jazz had. I also heard Bessie Smith as well, and I was quite knocked out by that.
Yeah, Martin's a big fan of Bessie Smith, isn't he?
Yeah, she's a very emotive singer. And then, of course, a lot of her band and session musicians were people that were also on these early jazz records. And so you'll probably recognise that feel. I was just thinking when you were saying, like, you know, that the modern stuff didn't do much for you. How much do you think that is connected to this stuff you're hearing from the age of 2 and 3 and 4 at your parents' house in the 78s, the skiffle or the trad jazz or whatever? Do you think you were just from a very early age that style of music crept in or what?
Well, my Uncle Mick had Art Blakey records, for example.
All right, so you had
I'd heard them, you know, as I was growing up in that very early formative period.
So you just don't like the noisy stuff then?
I think what it is
stuff with
about
the tune you like.
Yeah, about the sort of more modern forms of jazz, I tend to like the melodic. So yeah. I love Brubeck. And things, Jerry Mulligan and that sort of stuff, and the MJQ. But I don't like the Jazz Messengers. And I'm not a great fan of Parker and Gillespie and that sort of stuff. Although, you know, I'm more tolerant of it these days than I was, say, 20 years ago. I didn't like what I called the dirty boppers back then.
the greasy band. So just so it's 71, 72 where we are at the moment. You're about 18 years old, is that right? 17, 18, 19 years old? And you go to the Royal Albert Hall. Who's in the audience? Is it mostly 18-year-olds or is it more 30, 40-year-olds? So did you stand out like a sore thumb when you were there?
Well, not so much, because we mainly followed Max Colley's band around. Mm-hmm. And Max Colley had a lot younger image with his band. They were younger guys in general. And the audience there was quite a lot of younger people. They were older than we were, but only by about 10 years or so, which, you know, is about right, you know. Mm. But we would still have stood out. I mean, my friends, my peers, apart from Keith and Dave Bondy, another guy called Roy Goddard, who got into it as well, none of them could understand why we were listening to this weird old music when you could hear Hendrix and all of this sort of stuff that was around and the, you know, what I regard as the headbanging music.
we get the same thing really, but nowadays it's a big online things. It's a bit more accepted that you can find and listen to anything. We don't go to the record shops to find the old records now. They're just touch of a button away, you know, which is good and bad. But let's move forward a little bit then, John. So when was your first kind of proper gig, or what you quote unquote proper gig?
Right. Both Dave and I ended up going to Hard Tech in Essex, where we both lived. We found a trumpet player, a guy called Howell Williams, who could play a little bit. We had Keith come in on bass guitar. So we formed a little quartet.
On electric bass now.
He only played electric bass in those days,
right.
Bass guitar. And Keith, like me, is totally self-taught. I mean, he knows nothing about chords. Yeah, but he's got an uncanny ear, and you can throw any tune to him and he'll find the right bass line. You know, it's just remarkable. So we started playing around at college just as a rehearsal. Dave was playing clarinet with us, and we did a couple of, you know, some little gigs in the refectory playing for the students. And we found that the students actually quite liked what we were doing, cool. Which again, you know, we're talking about 1972, 73, probably around that period. Then I did an O-level, because I'd flunked my exams at school, really. I'd gone back to college to do O-levels and then A-levels. Halfway through the second year at college, Dave suggested to me that, you know, why didn't I consider doing music full-time? And I hadn't thought about that. And we'd also been following a band called the original East Side Stompers in East London, which again was a classic 1920s Hot Five, Hot Seven, Morton style band. And we were getting sit-ins by that time. The trumpet player there was Bill Brunskill, who was quite well known on the scene. And Bill was very helpful and encouraging. Keith and Dave and I had also been going to the Railway Hotel in Bishop Stortford, which was run as a monthly jam session for musicians by a chap called Bill Cornell, who you've met, Jack, because he's been at my festivals. He's still around now. He's
lovely man. Yeah, yeah.
93 this year and still wow. Drumming. And Bill was instrumental, really, in getting us started. You know, he let us sit in and all of that sort of stuff. So all of these sort of things were going on around that time. So via Bill Brunskill, I got my first gig. I decided I was going to try and get a band together. And there was the group of musicians that I'd met at the Railway Hotel. It was Terry Morrison, trumpet player, and Dickie Bird, a soprano sax player. We had a piano player called Don Stammers, banjo player called Colin Dyer. And we did a few gigs in my local parish social club. And that's started us. We did some gigs in the open air in Harlow Market. And then I decided that I was going to try and do something serious. So I went round the pubs in East London and found a gig at a pub called The Plough in Little Ilford Lane in Ilford in Essex. And I got 28 quid for the session on a Thursday night. So set about getting a band together. And I got Bill Brunskill to agree to do it on trumpet, Jim Gunton on trombone. Len Sparks played alto sax, so I knew from the Railway Hotel days. Banjo player called Colin Dyer. Arthur Risk, who was recommended to me by Bill Brunskill, who had played in Bill's band. And I can't remember, I think Keith had got married at that time, so we had a different bass player. I can't remember who that would have been. And that was my first actual, what I would call the beginning of doing proper gigs for reasonable, reasonable fees, peanuts, really. And from where we had that for, I don't know, about 6 months or so before we got the sack. And I then found a pub in Harlow where I lived called the Essex Skipper and got a Wednesday night residency in there with essentially, well, a similar band. That changed a little bit over the period. And eventually I was given the phone number of a cornet player called Ken Sims, who had been with Acker's band in the 50s on Acker's Hit Records.
And Acker I phoned Bilk, Ken. For Bilk, listening, yeah. You might not know. Yeah.
Acker Bilk's Hit Records in the late 50s, early 60s. And I asked him if he could do the gig, and he did. I'd also found a clarinet player called Dave Bailey, who I'd seen playing with Ken Collier's band, and he agreed to do it. And I had the nucleus of the band that I was going to use for many, many years. And that front line, Ken and Dave together, was just dynamite because they were both listening musicians. They would react to each other. Ken would play a phrase and Dave would play it straight back at him, you know, with a fraction of time difference. So it was very, very hot. Ken was very helpful to me. Bear in mind, I'd been playing drums for maybe 2 or 3 years. No, this is probably about 74, 75, but that's, say 3 years. I'd got very little technique in that I'd not learnt the rudiments properly. But he said to me that I got talent. And he said, you're too loud, particularly the bass drum. And he said, you've got to spend a lot of time listening to the music, because he said there was in New Orleans, the music was on every street corner, and that's how they learned to get the feel for the music. And he said, don't listen to white bands, listen to the black bands, go back to the source. And he said, Oliver, Armstrong, Morton, Fats Waller, Count Basie, all that sort of stuff. Well, of course, I didn't follow that rule exactly, because I was already quite heavily into Krupa and the Chicago stuff and the ODJB and that sort of thing. But I did listen to it and I did absorb it, and I made it my business, and still do, to continually listen to jazz as a, in an attempt to get the feel. Because when you consider that this isn't our native music, and the big problem that I've always had with European musicians, whether they're British tradies or European tradies, is that many of them didn't go back to the source material. So you're a lot of trad bands over here saying, oh yeah, we listen to the Barber Band and you know, the Kenny Ball Band and that sort of thing, and they never went back to where those people have got it from and that sort of thing. So, you know, basically gigs around pubs in that period. I talked the generals, the musicians union secretary at Harlow Tech into giving us a gig, because by this time we got a pretty tight New Orleans style band together playing classic stuff. So our repertoire included things like Snake Rag, Buddy's Habits, Froggy Moore Rag and these sort of things. And I took the student union into giving us a gig on one of their rock gigs, and they were very reluctant to do that, and they said you can have 20 minutes at the beginning of the show. So we went on and did it, and we started off with Snake Rag, and we got this big ensemble thing going. Ken used to describe it as being a big wheel. You know, you get the whole thing swinging along and just building up layer and layer and layer. And we ended up, I think, playing for an hour and a half, and wow, they didn't want us to stop.
Cool.
Wow.
And I thought we got this made. But of course, when I tried to get a gig the next year, there was a new student union who said, oh, jazz won't work or anything like that. So, and that's what happened. By 77, I decided that I was going to make a record. So we hired I found a record company that was interested in doing co-promotions with bands. And we did that. And we did a recording called Red Hot what did I call the first album? I think it was just called John Petter's Dixie Seven.
Was that the band name even when you were doing all these gigs and these pub gigs? Was that the band's name?
Well, I used the New Dixie Syncopators for a while.
The New Dixie Syncopators.
Yeah. And then I decided that I'd needed to put my name in front of it if I was ever going to get any sort of form of recognition. So we did that recording with Ken and a ragtime piano player called John Gill, who was phenomenal, who managed to consume. He insisted on doing his three solo rags first of all, and then polished off a bottle of scotch. So we ended up having to overdub part of Snake Rag because he went into the wrong sequence. So that was the first record
What kit were you playing now, John? So you've got an interesting story. You play a Ludwig now, right? Because I like my Ludwig, so I noticed your silver sparkle. So did you have this kit at this point?
No, I had an old Heyman kit.
Oh, cool.
That I used in those days. And I, you know, always played plastic heads. I never had any enthusiasm for calf heads because of the problems of keeping them in tune and all of that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And I played the Heymans until probably the mid-1980s when I got the Ludwigs.
Yeah, and have you got a cool story about that Ludwig, I believe, potential cool story?
Yes. Whether it's verifiable or not is, I don't know. But I bought the tom-toms and the bass drum from Alan Poston, who we knew as Slim Poston, sadly no longer with us. And he told me when I bought it off him that that very kit was played by Joe Morello when he was over here on tour in the 60s with Brubeck.
Very cool. He was a Silver Sparkle super classic guy, wasn't he? So there's a chance. There's a chance.
There is a chance, yes.
And what drew you to Ludwig?
Well, it was for sale, and I heard about it. I've never been hung up on particularly about makes of drums or that sort of thing. I've gone for sound, and I found that whatever drum kit I've had, I've managed to be able to tune so it sounds the way that I want it to sound.
Yeah, I've always thought that about you, actually. When you were kind enough to first meet you, like, I heard when we sat in your little shed and you showed me a few bits, I thought the sound was really good. That really big, open, wide snare and a big boomy bass drum. From it's like a 22 compared to some of these guys that we were playing 26s and 28s. But I've always thought you had a great sound, particularly that snare, or very Gene Krupa. I think I can really hear in your playing. I think you're one of the best examples of that style of playing that I know.
Well, thank you for that. And that is the sound of the snare that I like. I don't like damp drums. And when I did that first LP in 77, the recording engineer put dusters all over my drums. And you can hear halfway through the session that I pull them off. So the sound of the drums isn't constant right the way through. I just like them to sing back at me when I'm playing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay. So let's just move forward a little bit, and this is just something that I know about you. So I know you had a residency at the 100 Club, I believe, or you played at the 100 Club a lot, which is a famous famous London venue.
Yeah, well, this came after doing the album in 77. So by about 78, 79, 80, I had to get some sort of form of day job as well. So I bought a TV repair shop because I'd always been into electronics and radio and that sort of stuff.
Oh, cool.
So I was a semi-pro musician by then. And Ken Sims had got a residency on a Saturday night at the 100 Club for his Dixie Kings. So I went along and played in Ken's band. And we would usually play the support to the existing band. And I seem to remember we got the princely sum of 11 quid each.
Yeah, it's, the money's mad at that, isn't it? But I think the 100 Club's so interesting. I've been fortunate enough to play it once, but like, it's an amazing, the history of that room, because he still had a jazz night going. Well, so this is the 80s you're talking about as well. But
this was about 79, 80, you know, right. So it was still totally a jazz club in those days.
Oh, okay, right. I misunderstood, but I thought, from what I understand of it, when it went on to be a famous rock club and things like that as well, but they still had a jazz club going, which is very rare, and the walls in that place are full of all the amazing people who've played there, you know.
Yeah. So I mean, I did that for a couple of years, I think, until I got fired.
Oh, right. What happened there?
Well, Tim Phillips, who plays banjo, as you know, is also a drummer.
Yeah.
And I think his bass drum was quieter than mine.
Oh, I didn't realise Tim pinched your gig. Never realised that.
Bass drum again.
Yeah. Ken Sims
maybe,
had a thing about bass drums.
Maybe you should have dampened it a bit.
And who were, I know you played with some notable people at that 100 Club then. Can you give us a few examples and kind of tell us who they are?
Well, the people that sort of drifted in, we, champion Jack Dupree came in one night and sat in with the band. And Ken Sims turned round to me and said, whatever you do, don't listen to him, because sometimes he plays a 9.5 bar blues and sometimes it could be 13 bars. And he was absolutely right. He said, just bash the time out. So that was that. But subsequently, you know, there were a few other people that came in. We played opposite all of the named British bands that were on there, and they normally gave them a run for their money because Ken's band was very, very hot and very exciting.
When you say playing opposite, you don't mean like the Savoy style with Chick Webb, like Battle of the Bands thing, do you?
Well, no, there were two bands on a Saturday night. So you'd have the opening band, which was generally us, and the so-called name band.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ken was always competitive and wanted to take the trumpet players on and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, we used to give it one, as it were.
And the nights, they were busy now, these nights?
Yeah, Saturday nights, it was, you know, quite a people, lot of people were going there to dance mostly.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, it was that sort of scene by then. And I sort of not long after that, I started to change musical direction and went towards doing the swing band sort of stuff. Because I met Julian Stringle, who was then about 19.
Right.
And he was into the sort of Benny Goodman stuff. And I'd met up with Derek Winter, a Vibes player, and John Bumphrey, who I knew. And we formed a little Benny Goodman style quartet, which was... So,
up until now, you hadn't been kind of playing a lot of hi-hat or cymbal, really?
Oh, I had been, yes. But but my style had been basically a sort of a New Orleans sort of Chicago style, if you like.
Right.
But, you know, even with the swing band, I was still playing a lot of press roles and that sort of thing. So that would be 1983. And we did another recording. This was a live concert. I got involved, met up with Eddie Blackwell, who ran Essex Radio, which was the local commercial station. And he was very, very enthusiastic and gave me a live concert at the Towngate Theatre in Basildon and recorded it and gave us the tapes afterwards for us to put out on LP. And I got Pete Neighbour in on clarinet as well. So we had two reeds, Vibes, piano, bass and drums. My wife Tessa was playing bass on that session and also on the first LP that we did.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
So, but she was playing bass guitar in those days. So that was 83. And I was starting to dabble in running jazz clubs around that time in Harlow. And eventually ended up with a place called The Square in 1985, which was run by Essex County Council, and they gave me a budget to do with what I wanted. So wow. I put the band in and we got a variety of guests. And that's when I started working with the American soloists, as well as the name British soloists. And
For
me was a learning experience.
Yeah, so these were some of the American jazz artists now who were coming back over to Britain in during the revival, basically. So they still had a kind of name, right? But they were coming over without a band.
Yeah. They were coming over as soloists. The first one I worked with was Wild Bill Davison, which was in 1983.
Cool.
In the Playhouse bar, the first little place I ran. And that was a great experience. And of course, I'd grown up listening to the Wild Bill Bechet Blue Note record. So it was really weird to be playing with him.
Yeah, I bet that was amazing. I can't imagine playing with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I got to play with the likes of the stars I listened to when I was younger.
Yeah. So at the Square, we had Slim Gaylard a couple of times.
Cool.
That's amazing. We were listening to him yesterday. We put him on the background music at the gig that we did just so we could hear him.
Yeah, I was
that's
telling
amazing.
Here
we are 24 hours later and you played with him. That's amazing. Well,
he was an amazing character.
His songs are so funny and ridiculous. So
absolutely.
What was it like?
Absolutely. He was wonderful. He was hilarious. He did all of the things you've seen him do, the playing with the piano with his hands upside down and and all of that sort of stuff. He referred to me as his little drum buddy and to Keith as his little bass buddy and all of that sort of thing. I had Slim there twice.
Cool.
Once was during a festival that we put on, and on stage that night, I had Al Casey on guitar.
Wow.
Slim Gaylard on guitar and piano and whatever else he wanted to do. Georgie Fame was playing piano. We had Terry Lightfoot, Digby Fairweather, Ken Sims, and Jackie Free and Keith all on the stage for this massive, great big jam session.
That's and incredible. There's
a couple of photos that still survive, but no recording, sadly.
What a lineup that is.
That was amazing. Yeah. At the same festival, I'd had Ken Collier there, Cy Laurie and George Webb as well that day. It was an amazing event. It was the biggest thing that I'd organised up until that time.
So you organised all this and you booked all these guys?
Yeah.
Wow.
We had Billy Butterfield there as well. Yank Lawson, they were, and Kenny DeVerne, it was a key figure. And Al Casey, who I've mentioned. Al Casey first came in 85, and I rolled up to pick him up at the Pizza Express in Dean Street to where he was doing a recording for Hunt's Calligraph label with Wally Fawkes and Ian Christie and Stan Gregg and Jack Fallon. And I walked in, and Stan was going to play some of the session on drums and some on piano. And I'd just recently done a recording for Jazzology Records with Wally Fawkes, and he seemed to like my playing, and he saw me come in. He said, would you like to play on this album? He said, right. I can't pay you any money, but we'll come and do a gig for you instead. And the deal was done, and Humph was there producing it. So he thought, what the hell, and got his trumpet player out. So that's how I ended up on an LP with Al Casey and Humphrey Littleton and Wally Fawkes.
Oh, very cool. Wow. I'll have to try and look for that later. I'll listen to that.
Yeah, it's been unavailable for I'll send it to you.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, I should anyway, put it on YouTube.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was that. And 85 was key as well, because Kenny DeVerne appeared at the Square with the Cambridge City Jazz Band, and I got to sit in with them, and I talked to Kenny, and he was coming back to do some gigs later in the year, and I managed to arrange some trio dates with piano player Martin Litton, who you know, Jack, you worked with him, and we did a number of gigs around London with the trio, and I booked him to come to the Square to play with the swing band with Roger Nobes on vibes, and Martin on piano, and Keith by this time on double bass. And we recorded that for Essex Radio, and they gave me again the Betamax digital master, which we put out as the Live and Swinging CD. And I was a bit nervous because Kenny had a thing about not wanting to be a clone of anybody. And we wondered whether he was going to monster up at being put into a Benny Goodman style lineup, but he played extremely well, and gave us no trouble at all. He argued a bit with the audience because Kenny had a thing about insisting on playing acoustically, and he turned off all the PA in the place, and he said to the audience, "Can you hear me?" And someone said, "No." He said, "Go and listen to a rock band."
I love that. That's so cool. That's still happening in the 80s now we're in still. Yeah.
Yeah, this was 85.
Amazing.
The following week we did a trio recording with Kenny, with Martin, at the Pizza Express in Dean Street, which subsequently came out on Jazzology in New Orleans.
Is that the one in Soho?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I didn't realize the history of jazz there went back so far either. That's still like a good venue these days for jazz there.
Yeah, well, it was pretty well every night then. The guy called Dave Bennett, who also recorded the session, was responsible for booking it and that sort of thing. So that was those sessions. And then the following year, Yank Lawson was over, and I decided that I was going to record Yank Lawson. And we did that with a six-piece band with Jackie Free on trombone and Andre Beeson on reeds and Martin and Keith again. And we put that out on a cassette, first of all, and then subsequently on CD. And Yank was playing really well. He was about 74 years old at the time, but playing marvellously, as he'd done on the Bob Crosby recordings and all of those sort of things. That was about 86. And then the following year, I got a gig in the Soho Jazz Festival for my marching band. And we were playing marching around the streets of Soho with a parade band. And Art Hodes had been booked to do the festival. And they had a press gathering for a photo opportunity, and Art was playing the piano in Soho Square, and we accompanied him, and I took this opportunity to speak to him and sound him out about doing a recording, and he agreed to it. Had to pay him $1,000, which I didn't have in those days.
No, that's a lot of money.
Managed to scrape the money up, and I used Trevor Whiting on clarinet. Now Trevor and I had both had a similar listening experience, because we've both grown up listening to the Wild Bill Bechet Art Hodes recordings on Blue Note. And it was this weird feeling of, you know, playing on a date, let alone a recording with one of your heroes. So that was really weird. We did the session in Chiswick, and Art was very complimentary, and he said to Dave Bennett at the time, he said, book me with these guys next time I'm over. This is the first time it's been swinging on the tour. Well, of course, we were really chuffed about that.
Yeah.
Wow.
It didn't happen, of course, because we were young upstarts, and the guys that were almost the established jazz mafia in London got all of the gigs. So I thought, well, to hell with this. I'll book my own gigs and create the thing myself. So I booked Art Hodes. I booked Wild Bill to come back the next year. And we did. I got the Cork Jazz Festival for them and took the band together under my name as John Pesser's Dixielanders. And we sold out the Cork Opera House. I had two gigs there that particular festival.
How many seats is that?
Oh, probably about 500, maybe bigger. It was the main theatre in Cork. I also did the show with George Chisholm, who I'd met at the square as well. So I got a double go at the most prestigious venue in the Cork Festival. Well, both Bill and Art enjoyed the gig. We recorded them for the CD together again, and I asked them if they'd like to come back, and they said they would. They'd been used to coming over here and working with pickup bands. And I had this idea that I would get a set personnel together and we would put it out as a package, which we duly did. And I started trying to sell it in the theatre venues. No one had heard of Wild Bill Davison or Art Hodes. And I was, you know, being helped by a retired lady named Gwen Main, who had very good sales experience. And she gave me a room in her house as an office, as we were living in a one-bedroom flat with a one-year-old baby at the time. So, so she ended up doing a lot of my agenting for me. And she said, you need a unique selling point. So we racked our brains. And I said, well, both of them worked for Al Capone in the 20s.
Yes. Said,
that's it. So we sold the whole tour, The Legends of American Dixieland, on that fact that they both worked for Capone.
Very cool.
And did that get good press then? Did that go far and wide and sell a lot of tickets?
Yeah, we got about, I think it was a dozen or so dates for them. Some of them we took on percentages. One of them was very badly advertised. It was advertised on the wrong date. So that more or less wiped out the profit that we made from the tour pretty well.
And I think that's super interesting, John, in like, there's a couple of things you mentioned there. Did you, did you just kind of think, oh, I really want to play with these people, let's see if they want to come to the UK? So did you reach out to them, or did you have a kind of, not a list, but you knew who was coming to the UK and who you might be able to play with? And secondly, me and Martin talk about it quite a lot, it's interesting just kind of personalities in music. I feel like you mm-hmm. wanted to make something happen, so you kind of took it by the reins and booked gigs and made it happen, because we've all been in situations where you want to make something happen, but no one grabs hold of it and does it. So it's like, right, well, I better do it then. So that's super interesting that you've done that.
Yeah, that's exactly how I did it. I mean, I'd met Bill in 83, so I already knew Bill, and I'd met Art at the Soho Festival, so I'd already established those contacts. So it was a case of organising it. At the time, you had to get work permits for American musicians, and that was a real headache going through all of that procedure, and the musicians union were against it, so you had to go overcome that hurdle. But I wanted to use Jackie Free on trombone, who had done a wonderful job on the recording with Yank Lawson, and Jackie was having health issues at the time and could only really do the local gigs. So we got Campbell Burnap, who was a fine trombone player, in the trombone seat for that. And Dave Bailey on the tour in 89 on clarinet, and Keith and myself. And I turned up at Heathrow Airport to meet Bill from his flight, and he was pushed through customs in a wheelchair. This bode's dodgy. We've got umpteen dozen dates ahead of us. And he's 83 years old, and he's in a wheelchair. And he brought his wife, Annie, with him, who used to look after him on the tour. And Art brought his wife, Jan, with him, who used to do duets with him on as part of the show, which was wonderful. And we set off on this tour. The first one was in Norwich, which Louis Lintz videoed on vintage Sony U-matic video. There's a couple of videos of that on YouTube from that sessions. And my friend Terry Maton and Louis, we formed a label called CMJ Records, and we bought some digital recording equipment to record direct to digital stereo, and we recorded all of the sessions. And Louis got video of two of them as well, the Harlow concert and so on. And we did two dates in Northern Ireland that Mike Poynton did on trombone with us. And it was a tremendous experience.
What was tremendous about it then? Like, was it the stories that they had to tell, or the playing experiences, or... And also, like, were these, like you said that you'd played with these guys earlier, how in touch with these guys? Did you speak to them regularly? Did you phone them regularly? Or was it just every now and then you'd fire some possible dates across and then they chose some?
It was done by phone in those days, which is incredibly expensive.
I bet.
You know, I mean, you didn't have the sort of communications facilities we've now got.
So you had to keep the calls quite short.
Just very short,
Yeah, okay. Whereas nowadays you can probably talk for hours with these, you know, these guys, and they can tell you amazing stories, and then make a podcast out of it.
Yeah. So what actually happened? It was the anecdotes, the experience on the road, the stories.
Did they have any stories that about some of the biggest stars that they'd played with? Anything that you can tell us, or you know, you could change names and tell us?
Well, I was particularly interested in quizzing Bill about playing with Gene Krupa, for example.
Yes, of course.
And while he was at my house, I played him the recording of Bonaparte's Retreat with that country and western singer Bobby Soots on it.
Yeah.
Bill Shaw remembered that, although he hadn't heard it in about 50 years.
That's amazing. So he got to hear his own record back.
Yeah.
That must have been fascinating.
Yeah, and I was particularly interesting to quiz him and Kenny DeVerne about the session that they did at the Jazz at the New School with Gene Krupa in 1972. And I also asked Bill about Baby Dodds and how he found, and he said Baby was great and that he was an old style drummer. And Bill told me that his favourite drummer was Cliff Lehman. So, you know, we got into those sort of discussions. Art Hodes, of course, I was able to quiz on the people that he'd worked with, and you know, so it was very valuable from that point of view.
Yeah, and so these chaps are, you say, like in their 80s by this point, and they're on tour, and by the sound of it, you know, in some ways like elderly or whatever. Yeah. What kind of spirits were they? Were they happy to be out? Were they okay touring? How were they playing? Like how strong was their playing by that point?
Well, I'd done a recording with Wild Bill in '86 that wasn't very good. Bill was suffering from ulcers and all sorts of problems, and his lip wasn't in good shape. And we thought when we did the Together Again recording in '88 that if we got one or two tracks with Bill on it that were acceptable, then that would suffice. And we do the rest of them with Art Hodes and the small group. But as it turned out, he was good on all of them pretty well. And by 89, you know, even at the age of 83, he recovered his lip and he was playing very, very well. He wasn't the Wild Bill of 1943, but he wasn't going to be, but he was still Wild Bill. And Art Hodes sounded no different, you know. He got
really
I mean he had a very, very powerful rolling left hand drenched in the blues. He's the closest white piano player to playing black blues that I think there has ever been. And there was an interesting remark that Kenny DeVerne made to me, because in 88 I was booked to appear at Cambridge for the Cambridge Jazz Club and at Eastbourne at the Towner Gallery with Kenny DeVerne and Art Hodes. Kenny and Art had worked together with a drummer called Dom DeMichael and had made a wonderful LP called, I think it's either the Hot Three or the Blue Three, one or the other. And we'd heard that record, and it's tremendous. And I was, you know, honoured really to be asked. And you know, I thought then things are really starting to go somewhere where I'm being invited to work with these guys. And then I got ceremoniously unbooked by Cambridge because I had the chance of booking an American drummer who was also over here. And I can't remember which American drummer was, but it was one of the ones that's rated. And I wouldn't tell you who it was, even if I knew. And I turned up at the Towner Gallery the next night, and Kenny DeVerne grabbed me and he said, listen, he said, whatever you do, don't listen to Hodes, because his timing's all over the place. He said, we had so-and-so on drums last night and it was a disaster because he was following him. Well, I thought, okay, what am I going to do about this? And Art's timing wasn't all over the place. Art's timing was fine. But I knew exactly what Kenny meant, because Art would lay back on the beat. So you've got this breadth of time. And so long as you just kept on top of it, it was great. And there were no problems. And Kenny told me that I could issue that recording, which I never did. I've still got it here, but it's unissued. It remains unissued today. But there's some great stuff on there from both Kenny and Art. So yeah, it was those sort of things. You learned what I learned from those musicians was economy, a lot about the blues, about where you phrase things, because British jazz could be a little bit uptight. Over fussy, over busy, and that sort of thing. So with all of those Americans, I learned about relaxation and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's there's no other way to get that really than you know, being in the room and doing those gigs and spending time with those people. So that's better than any, you know, college education really, isn't it? So I think that's, and it's amazing that you were instrumental in making that happen and stuff. And I think that's should give you a credit really for keeping these guys going in the UK and giving them these opportunities really.
Yeah, well, I got in on the last knockings because we had Bill and Art were over in May 89, and he was dead by November.
Wow.
So, oh, my goodness.
Literally, I may have the last Wild Bill Davison recordings. I don't know. One of them was subsequently issued on the CD Coalition in the States on Jazzology. But I got a whole, maybe a dozen shows that will probably never be released because there isn't a market for them.
Okay, so let's we're getting towards the end of this interview now, John. So let's I just got a couple of things to ask about. So now you're still running festivals now. I've been lucky enough to do a couple. So have you got any of them that you might be able to advertise on here or mention?
Well, I won't be running festivals anymore. The pandemic thing really has put a stop to that. It was running down anyway, and I had decided that I was going to pack it up a year before, 2019 was going to be the last one. And I had my arms twisted to do two in 2020, which, of course, didn't happen.
Yeah.
I will be doing gigs when the pandemic's over. Quite what exactly I'll be doing, I don't know.
That's fair enough.
Does anybody?
No, that's fine. I understand why you were so good at running those festivals, basically, and why they worked so well, because you've got a history in booking and organising stuff. So that's great. And then you've been running, so I know you're into your radio, and you've been doing a kind of online jazz show, essentially. Now you have Jazz. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's fun. I did it first of all in 2018 on the local internet station, and it went down very well. Apparently, I get more listeners than any other program that they've got on their schedule. And just recently, it's been taken up by the Syncopated Times radio network in the States. So they're running it three times or four times on Fridays. So that's been good. And rather than just play records, I've been doing interviews with musicians as well. So I've had the wonderful Hal Smith has been doing a few, and I've got one coming up with Chris Tile next week, and Lauren Schoenberg's done one, and Clint Baker and people like that. So those are coming up in the next few weeks. So that's been quite good fun. I ran Rose Records with my wife Tessa for many years. We managed to do probably over 40 albums, I think, over the period of years, which usually went together with my themed theatre shows, or specific projects that I had in mind with different musicians. The last one I did was with Ben Holder, the wonderful young swing violin player. And that was a good fun recording. But CDs are finished now. So quite where recorded music is going, I don't know. It seems like the pandemic is going to be a major recalibration for everybody, me included.
And in everything, isn't it? But
definitely.
Yeah. Okay, amazing. Finally, so we've got a few questions that we ask all people on this podcast. They're just kind of quick fire questions, if you want. We've got a couple of minutes left, if you want to give some quick answers to these. So first of all, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Go and learn the rudiments.
Perfect answer. Yeah, I would agree with that. How would you explain your job to a five-year-old?
Oh, how do you become a millionaire playing jazz? you start off as a billionaire.
I thought the first part was a good joke. Second part even better. Okay, and in a film of your life, who would play you?
Oh. Well, that's, I have no idea.
It's a vanity question. This is where we see how vain you are. Brad Pitt.
I honestly don't know how to answer that. I can't think of anyone.
That's fine. You're too unique, John.
Nobody can capture that.
And then finally, how do you like your tea?
My tea? Oh, milk, no sugar, generally. Or if it's Earl Grey, black.
Yay. A gentleman.
Well, thank you so much for your time, John. Yeah, it's been great to have a conversation with you today. I hope people check out you and all your brilliant recordings in your own radio show. And hopefully you've taught us a lot. I know there's lots of names I've written down that I need to look up. So hopefully other people will do the same and continue to be educated by people like yourselves. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, chaps. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honour.
Thank you very much. See you again.
Keep swimming. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.